Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer. And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Brothers.
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over.
Mr. Jackson, sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it. I'll see you today. Get him where it hurts.
Starring Gary Dordan from TVCSI.
This is the military, David.
Revolutionary greetings. This is Sister Rue, also known as Fatumi Shay. I also have one of my brothers on the line with me, co-hosting this evening. That's Brother Kassam. Brother, you here?
Yes, yes, yes. I'm Jumbo, everybody. I'm
okay.
Jumbo.
See, Jumbo, thank you for being on the call this evening, joining me. So this is Juicy Radio Talk Show, and we bring in another Black August edition. Normally, Juicy do shows every other week. We haven't in a couple of months just because different things have been going on. But we normally do shows every other Tuesday. But for Black August, we felt like it was necessary for us to bring as much information as possible for everyone. So we said that we would do weekly shows during Black August. So also, we decided that we wanted to cover a variety of topics in regards to resistance. So we wanted to touch on a topic that a lot of people don't think about as far as when it comes to resistance, like it's so many different ways that we are, that we have and that we are being resistant in the struggle. So this week, our topic is resistance with physical training and embracing the warrior spirit. And we'll bring our guest speaker on shortly, but we all know that definitely physical training is necessary in the struggle. I feel like it's something that a lot of us have gotten away from. So when I heard the brother on, the brother Abdul on GJU a few weeks back, I was thinking, and I was like, wow, we definitely need that encouragement to be training, to get back on track from the physical aspect, because that's needed day to day. You know what I mean? It's life saving.
Absolutely.
Sometimes, you know, just knowing basic hand-to-hand combat skills, or maybe, you know, different type of weapons or whatever that you can use, like, that's necessary to get to be saving our lives on a daily basis. Well, you know, you never know what situation might arise with the nature of our environment. So I definitely wanted to bring him on so that we could get motivated. Because a lot of us have gotten really relaxed, really complacent, and that's not a good way to be. Like, we can't never forget that we at war, so it's definitely not a time to not be training in all aspects. So I also wanted to say, like, the other many ways of resisting, like, we're bringing people on next week. We're bringing on two, and we wanted to try to balance it. We wanted to bring more of a balance and, you know, discuss women freedom fighters. We wanted to really acknowledge and honor the women in the struggle also. And so we wanted to also talk about women's issues on this month, the things that we did. So next week we have some sisters coming on, and they're going to be talking about being like foster mothers, foster parents, talking about being birth workers for our sisters in the community. Because, like, we at war when it comes to medical facilities, like, you know, every aspect, our children, we need to be taking our children more. We need to be taking, like, things like foster care more seriously, because, like, how can we be in a struggle and acknowledge and understand the depths of everything that's happening, but more of them might be adopting our children than we are? Like, that's not making any sense. So this month, we're trying to come at all angles for, you know, to discuss awareness, to give education. We got people coming on talking about the education system. We're trying to cover a little bit of everything, which is why we say we were going to do it every week this month. So.
Yeah, and you know, sister, everything you said was definitely on point, man. I think what a lot of people do understand, at least on a surface level, that the struggle is multifaceted, that the same holistic thing that we seek to impose on our individual lives, we got to also impose that on the struggle as a whole. So it's definitely important, man, as far as physical training and not detaching the physical from the mental, because physical training has everything to do with a person's mental capabilities, you know what I'm saying, in the sense of being prepared, you know what I'm saying, for that type of personal struggle, to get motivated, you know, to realize, like Comrade George said, the seriousness of the situation that we're in. Sometimes, you know, we get a little little sidetracked and thinking, you know, everything is okay, or in the least, you know, what used to happen can't start happening now. Well, the reality is it's already happening now. You know, the question is whether or not we're prepared and ready to confront those types of struggles. So it definitely starts, you know, the physical is a manifestation of the mental being a manifestation of the spiritual. So we really do have to pull all these things together to realize, you know, preparing for our open and common enemy is probably one of the most revolutionary things that we can do at this point in time in our struggle, is being ready, man, being prepared. The same thing we like to prepare our children, you know, coming up in the schoolyards, and, you know, don't let nobody push you around. Don't let nobody bully you. Stand up for yourself. You know, at the same time, we got to promote that mental, spiritual, and physical wellness for our children to be able to, you know what I'm saying, actually defend themselves, especially being an African in this society. We're going to have to be able to be martial artists in more than one way than just the physical. So I'm excited.
And
I'm excited that the brother's going to come on and give us his experience.
Right. We do also have a sister coming on. I think she's coming on the last week to talk about resistance from a spiritual aspect. So we didn't leave that out, because I'm like, yeah, that's real important. That's like spirit, yeah, that's real important. So we did add that in there. I just want to throw that out real quick, because you had mentioned it. But, like, I'm excited, too, because I ain't going to lie. Like, I fell off on my physical activity just, you know, getting caught up day to day, working, doing all kinds of other stuff, and not really making time for myself. And then when I'm taking, like, maybe I might take a walk of a flight of stairs, two flight of stairs, I'm tired, I'm out of breath. I'm like, that's not acceptable. So
yeah.
I'm like, I got to hold myself more accountable. Like, I'm not, no, they're like, this is not supposed to be like this. So I started, like, before August. I was like, I got to start getting myself prepared for Black August. And so, like, I would walk, like, 2 miles, sometimes 3 miles, like, before I go to work in the morning. So I was like, I just, like, I got to get on the ball. A lot of us got to get on the ball with the physical activity. So I'm excited to have a brother come on too, because I know I need the motivation for myself, and I know I'm not the only one that needs it.
Right, and you know, yeah, nobody's the only one doing anything. Right. Black August is the training ground. This is the training camp. You know,
exactly.
This is the gym. This is the time we take out to at least, you know, if there's no time in the year that we remember the condition that we're in, Black August is the time. I like to tell people, you know, who have a misconception about Black August, that this Black August is not violent. Black August is the remembrance of violence. All the people who are
right.
commemorated are people who fell at the hands of their open and sometimes secret enemy. So, yeah, this is definitely the time to, you know, get in the shape, you know, start trying to build up that will of perseverance, you know, and hopefully continue that throughout the year.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to do. So, the brother that we're about to bring on, Brother Abdul, like, I'm going to say again, I'm excited to have him come on. His name is Abdul Kwawi Al-Afriki. He's a very proud revolutionary brother, black nationalist, professional MMA fighter. And I feel good about that, just to be able to say we got a brother that's unapologetic MMA fighter, you know, and he's always, like, I looked on his Facebook page, he always repping the RBG, and he's a grassroots organizer, self-defense coach, fitness trainer, he's a member of BLM, he's a citizen of the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa. So we're grateful that with all that he does, everything that he's currently doing and involved in, so we're grateful that he's taking the time out this evening to give us a word, to give us some education, and to give us some encouragement for this Black August. So I just unmuted your line, brother. We're happy to have you.
Thank you. Thank you, sister. And to all the listeners, I want to say free the land.
Free the land.
Yes. Free the land.
I will by any means necessary.
So, brother, it is good to have you. We've been gassing you up. You know, I told the sister, man, I'm excited, man. I'm excited to have a strong new African brother on the line that's, man, in my opinion, we far, far too underrepresented, man, as a nation of people in the MMA field. So
exactly.
It's definitely an honor to have you on.
I appreciate it, and it's an honor to be on. It's definitely an honor. It always is an honor to speak with my people, man. So, where did we start?
Well, I have a question for you. Like I said, we far too underrepresented in the MMA field. So, if you can first, you know, give the listeners a little, you know, backstory as to who you are, you know, how you became who you are now, and you know, what was it like, you know, coming into becoming, you know, a conscious new African, and having that particular skill set to be able to contribute to the movement?
Oh, okay. Well, I would say, I would like to first say what is most important, that I come through the matriarchal lineage of a woman by the name of Mary Sunshine. She instilled in me and my brothers at a very early age revolutionary principles at an early age. She herself didn't even realize that some of the principles in which she was teaching us came from her ancestral, so to speak, lineage, so to speak. She didn't understand it, but it was just already in her to tell love of self, love of people, and just to be proud of who she was. So she taught us at an early age about Malcolm X and even Martin Luther King and George Jackson. So I did grow up in a home learning about struggle and fighting. I will say that just like everyone else experienced, and just like we know about the laws of contradiction, that external influences always affect the internal. So even though I had that type of mother, we had that type of mother who was in our home teaching us, the external influences affected our development. The same way that the flower is affected by the sun, which is external, by the rain, which is external. Those things have to exist for the flower to grow, the external influence. So certain external influences led myself, my brothers also, into what's commonly known as gang culture, which we identify as New African Revolutionary Nationalists as street tribes. But what's referred to by most as gang culture, certain criminal acts, it led us into these types of things. What we see the majority of the black and New African youth doing today, we were doing. This eventually led me into prison. Me being at this time, I became a known gang leader around my city, around the western part of the state. I was a known gang leader, and I was sentenced. I was shot in an attempted bank robbery. I was shot by a black man who wasn't a security, who was what they called a good Samaritan. So I was shot by him in a so-called attempted bank robbery, in which no gun was found, no evidence was there, no camera footage at a bank. But however, I went to trial and I was still convicted. My first serious offense, 18 years old, and I was sentenced to 10 and a half years in prison with a paid attorney, who was black, by the way, who pretty much sold me down the drain. So my years in prison eventually led me to becoming a conscious citizen of the Provisional Government of Republic of New Africa. My early years in prison, of course, I was still involved in gangs. I was still involved in drug culture. I was still involved in senseless violence against my own. I was pretty much what most of us have been programmed to be. And then I began to meet brothers who were former Black Panthers, who were Miles International Ministry, Revolutionary International Movement, RAM, MOVE. I began to get around brothers like Jameer Alameen, and these brothers took me into re-education camp, so to speak. That's the best way I can describe it. They took me into the education camp. That's the best way I can describe it. Learning upon learning about why I thought the way I thought, why I did some of the things I did, why my brothers and why the people around me and why the people in our community do some of the things that they do, I felt propelled to change myself while simultaneously trying to change my condition and the conditions of my people. I felt compelled to do that. So I began to organize in prison. Organizing on every level. Just like Malcolm X said, black liberation should be fought on every front simultaneously. So I began to organize on every level, organize against the prison staff for certain atrocities that they would commit, because they commit atrocities against the prisoners every day. Prison is just pretty much a microcosm of what we see outside, what we see here, on the streets, so to speak. It's only a microcosm times 10. The reason why I say times 10 is because you see the pig get away with murder on the street, and it's no checking mechanism at all in prison. Even black people don't care about the prisoners because they believe that if you're in jail, you're supposed to be there because you're a bad person, i.e. the war on drugs, the war on gangs, the war on this, the war on that. That white people put to the media and put to the public. So I began to organize against these things, and we found and I learned that the best way of organizing, organization starts from the bottom up, not the top down. So we organized the masses of people, the critical mass of the people, the black people, and in organizing against the administration, and organizing against some of the atrocities, and organizing against some of the dehumanization that was being done in prison, I found that I became a target. I found that I became a target to staff. I became a target to, once I became a target to staff, unbeknownst to me, they were collecting information already on certain black nationalist people. Before this term black identity extremist was even mentioned, I know for a fact back in 2008, 2009, the powers to be, I'm going to tell you who they are, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, the Department of Justice, and the state DOC were already amassing information on black nationalists and people with so-called communism, socialist type of ideologies. And they were watching you. They were watching you. You were an enemy to them. So for these reasons, I was placed in a terrorist unit known as Special Management Unit. They trumped up charges against me, and all of this is public record, saying that I was a threat to their institution. I was a threat to the staff due to organizing. This is the word that they use, organizing. You are not allowed to organize in the penitentiary, so much so that in the federal penitentiary, they have a rule that says that three or more persons cannot be in a group. Three or more persons cannot be in a group together. Sometimes, most of the time, they don't follow this rule. But if they see a brother with the affinity from the black people, such as H. Rob Brown, if they see him with four or five people around him, then they're gonna come and and make you disperse. That's what the white officers or the lackeys who are black are going to do. They're going to come and make you disperse. So in 2013, I was sent to Special Management Unit in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. This is a best way I can explain this prison was I was locked down. So-called 23-1, but I was practically locked down all day, every day for the next 3.5 years. Where, it was a brother who called because he understood what I was saying. Anybody look up the Special Management Unit, they're gonna understand exactly what I mean. I was locked down 24 hours a day, where the pigs, you were at their mercy. They fed you when they wanted. They didn't have to feed you. You bathed when they allowed. You were given books when they allowed. I went months without talking to my family. I went months, years without receiving letters, because it's the pigs who allow the letters to go out, and it's the pigs who decide whether they're going to give you the letter or not. I was physically attacked by them often. It was a mental battle. But I was already prepared through re-education, through these re-education camps that's going on behind the wall. I want the people to understand that some of the best education is going on in certain pockets in the penitentiary. Like our brother George Jackson said, from the most oppressed conditions come the most change. From the most oppressed conditions come the most oppressed people have the largest propensity towards revolution. So inside of some of these penitentiaries, brothers are organizing, sisters are organizing, comrades and warriors who may never come home are teaching and lending every resource that they have to those who will come home to prepare for the inevitable event. So this is what's going on in prison. I was given direction. I came home focused, even after I came from the special management unit. When I first went into the special management unit, I was approached by SIA. SIA inside of prison is called, that is the Special Investigation Agent. The SIA, he is an officer of the court. The SIA responds directly to the prosecutor, and they have like one SIA. They have one agent per penitentiary. And this agent spoke with me privately and said, if you do what you have been doing, you won't go home. That was a threat. That was their threat. The threat to me was basically, if you keep organizing, you keep writing the things that you write, you keep bucking against our system, you won't go home. We'll keep you here, or we'll kill you. When I was in that unit, I heard men cry for their mothers. I heard men cry for their mothers. In this unit, it is no fighting back in this unit. The reason why there's no fighting back, see, in a penitentiary, you could fight an officer back, even though they have the weapons, they have the tear gas, they have the shock shields. So they have the weaponry, so they're almost 10 times out of 10 going to win, 9 times out of 10. But in this unit, you never had an opportunity to which you can place hands on the pig. You are always locked down 24 hours a day, and when they want to come for you, they just open a slot and gas you. And when they gas you, then they come in with their shock shields, and they come in with their sticks, and they come in with their boots, and 10 of them are on you. However, they still come and do this day in, day out. Day in, day out. I went to Allenwood Special Management Unit, in which the same things go on. In these towns, such as Lewisburg, such as Allenwood, the majority of the workers there are the white rural people of that area. And these white people held ties with the KKK. They held ties with all types of white nationalists. So whenever you find a white nationalist in special management unit, usually for being a gang leader, they do just fine. Because we have saw that the white men call the white nationalists brother. They give them extra food. They have a more comfortable experience than we have. They have a more comfortable experience than we have. So I'm going to fast forward. So when I came home from prison, I was already given direction from the people to come organize, to come bring the skills that I have to my people. And that's what I came to do. Before I came home, my mother told me that she had people already in place. My mother, Mary Sunshine, had people already in place that were waiting on me so that we could link up and we could begin to organize and I could bring the resources that I have to the community. So I linked up, the sister said BLM, not Black Lives Matter, you know, because their politics are diametrically opposed to ours, but to an organization called Black Liberation Movement, which was spearheaded in Mississippi, which is pretty much a continuation of every Black Liberation Movement that has taken place since the first slave, since the first black person was made a slave. So this organization was spearheaded in Mississippi, and the foundation of this organization is about land. Just as the Republic of New Africa is about land, it's about seizing the land. So I aligned myself with this organization and began to work inside this organization, and I began to organize the youth, not just in this organization, but in other gangs, me being a former member of the Blood Gang, the Street Tribe, what we call them now. I began to go inside every neighborhood, each neighborhood that I can, whenever I could, and began to try to organize the people around that in which they say they believe. For an example, Blood. If anyone knows the history of these gangs, the Bloods, the Crips, they came as a direct result of white supremacy or police brutality. One of the acronyms, one of the most widely used acronyms for CRIP is Community Revolutionary International Political Soldier. One of the most widely used acronyms for Blood is Brotherly Love Overriding Oppression Destroying Societies. Even if you look to the GDs, who eventually became Growth and Development, you look to the Black Peacestone Rangers out west, who were having vocational schools inside of the communities and all of these types of things here, even the Vice Lords. These street tribes came as a direct result of what was going on inside of the community, and the things that were going on inside of the community were going on due to external influences, were going on due to racism, white supremacy, capitalism. This is the reason why these organizations, these street tribes came. So we go inside the neighborhoods and we try to educate the young people of these gangs about the origin of their street tribe. As opposed to trying to take it away from them, we just try to redirect them. Because one thing I have learned is that when you try to, you can't take anything away from a person if you don't have something to give them in return. So a lot of times we go into these neighborhoods and we say, well, you shouldn't be selling crack. We know, we may know the ill effect of crack cocaine in our neighborhood. Of course we know that. And everybody who's listening to this show, I know this is not a topic of debate right now because we all know that. But those in the neighborhood who are in dire conditions, who are trying to provide for themselves, trying to navigate the system of racism, white supremacy, trying to get school clothes for their children, trying to provide for their wives and their sons and their daughters, capitalism creates competition to where you don't care what goes on in the next person's house. And you don't realize the interconnectedness of everybody in the community. You don't realize the interconnectedness of everybody in this country and all over the diaspora if you're Black. We don't realize the interconnectedness because capitalism, which creates competition, it also breeds rugged individualism. So we don't realize that. So what we do, as opposed to saying don't sell crack, we try to go in and we try to show them what crack does to people's mothers and people's daughters, or what heroin does, and we try to give them an alternative. You have to give them an alternative, and we have found that this is currently the best method if you're gonna help some of the people. Now, all of them, most of them aren't gonna oblige. Most of them are not. So it's other ways that you have to deal with certain people, and that may be another topic not to be spoken on this show today. But as far as with the youth, this is the best method to go to them and try to give them an alternative, or to get them when they're at the age to where you can teach them differently. Another thing that I do is self-defense, and I teach self-defense for free in our neighborhood, in our communities. I go out and I teach it for free. It's imperative. Self-defense is imperative. It's imperative that we learn how to defend ourselves. I believe that every Black man, woman too, but the primary goal, the primary responsibility of every Black man is to protect and to defend his community. And the proof for that is not based on any gender role. It's based on common sense to me. I say that men, for whatever reason, are created physically stronger than women. I don't say that men are better than women, nor women better than men. I say that we are equal in our role. But men are created physically stronger than women. So since we are created physically stronger than women, that means that we should protect the women, and we should protect the children. So I say it is incumbent and it's imperative that every man learns how to fight, learns how to use the limbs that the Creator gave him to defend himself, to defend his family. We also encourage everyone who's able, and those who can't also, just to be honest, we encourage you to carry weapons. Because the best way to stop a cracker with a gun who's trying to kill you is to have you a gun.
Right on.
The best way to
The best way to stop a cracker with a gun who coming into a Walmart to kill you is to have a gun. So if the KKK decide to come into a community in which we are in, the best way for us to defend our families against them is to fight them, not to call nobody, not to call no police, because the police work with the KKK. The police are the KKK. Uh-huh. The police are slave patrol. They are an apparatus of white supremacy. They are us inside of our community. The same way the pigs and the same way the imperialists occupy Somalia and North Africa, and the same way the Jew occupies Palestine. The police are an occupying force inside of our community. So what we do right now, and we're gonna talk about this more in Mississippi, September 18th through September 21st, we are organizing a community response unit. It's not going to be in every community, but what we're doing is we're placing theory into practice, because a lot of us got the theory, but we ain't got the practice. Fred Hampton said theory without practice ain't shit. I'm not saying that theory is better than practice, nor I'm saying that practice is better than theory, but we got to start putting some of this theory into practice. So what we have began to do is organized community response units. And inside of these community response units, guess what? You ain't got to understand. You don't have to be able to verbalize completely what it means to be a new African, or you don't have to verbalize completely capitalism or socialism or imperialism. You don't have to verbalize this. You have to have a nationalist sentiment, meaning you love those who look like you and you're willing to protect them, and the rest you will learn from trial and error. The rest you will learn from trial and error. So that means that we have some people inside of the community response units who are Crips. We have some people inside of the community response units who are Bloods. But we are all together on a common goal, meaning we have this nationalist sentiment, this love for black people. And those of us, I hate to use the term at the top, but they respect those of us who can make the decisions. And the decisions are based on the theory. They are based on black nationalism, on how we move forward. But the point is with the community response units is that many issues that go on inside of black neighborhoods, black communities, can be handled and resolved by black people. For an example, if a sister is having a domestic dispute, you mean to tell me that the people inside that community can't come and solve that domestic dispute between her and her husband or her and her boyfriend?
Right.
I mean, they can come and resolve it. If they got to put hands on him, then put hands on him. And if they have to separate them, then separate them. But those types of things can be resolved without calling the pig to our community. And the pig comes inside of our community, and they kill us. They come inside of our community, and they whoop us. And then when they come inside of our community, they say, how y'all going to say y'all hate them, or how y'all going to say y'all don't want us here when we get X amount of calls from y'all every day? We get X amount of calls from y'all every day. If we begin to read what the pigs say, and we begin to read what the United States government says, and what each city and each state say about why the police patrol urban communities, they're going to say we patrol urban communities because we call the most there. And that's true, because black people call the police every day. Black people call the police every day, and it's a contradiction for this community to call the police while some in the community simultaneously say we don't want the police here. So if we don't want the police here, we don't want the occupying force here, then we need to first start by policing our own. That's what we need to do. There are other measures that we should be doing simultaneously as well, but at this time, right now, we need to begin by policing our own. So
I'm so glad you introduced this, and it seems like this conversation is getting ready to take a turn, but for the better. You introduced the question of, you know, gun ownership, you know, legal gun ownership, period. As a conscious new African myself, you know, I'm a avid supporter of the human right to bear arms. My question for you is, why do you feel like the new African or black community is open to the idea of engaging in that type of awareness.
Brother, it's hard. Especially, okay, I think that's a great question because these conversations are being had right now in the light of what has happened in Dayton, Ohio, and yesterday, in the light of what has happened in Texas. These conversations are being had. And I think due to us being in Babylon for so long that the masses of the people, the masses of the black people, believe that guns aren't necessary. This is what the masses of the people believe. Guns aren't necessary, and the masses of them aren't open to it. The masses of them, of the people, are sold to the Democratic Party. And if everyone who's listening pays attention to the Democratic Party, first we know that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are the same thing. The only difference is the rhetoric in which they're used, but their policies are the same. It's just a small difference, but they both work towards the and they both maintain white supremacy. The only difference is who gets the money and when they get the money. That's the only difference. So, but the majority of black people are Democrats right now. And the Democrats right now, the Democrats have been pushing that the gun is the issue and that we don't need guns. And the majority of the common black people who believe that they are African-American, because the majority of black people say that they are African-American. They don't say that they're New African. Or they don't ascribe to any form of black nationalism. They are not open to it. But I don't believe. I've moved past the belief that the critical mass of the people has to be on the same exact thing. See, those of us who know better, those of us who are studying right now, we know that we must arm ourselves to fight. We know that. We know that we must arm our families. We must defend our families. So those of us who know, who are organizing, I think that that's enough, and we should be trying to win over as many people as we can. But if the majority of black people were open to that, then, I mean, I think that we would be a little bit more further in revolution right now. That's not saying that we aren't, because I know that even if the black people being quiet, even if you're not hearing about struggle, history tells us that black people are struggling. Wherever you find oppression, you find its opposite. Wherever you find oppression, you find its opposite. And the dominant society is not going to propagate that black people are in the streets, and black people are in the streets organizing against white people for the betterment of their people. They're not going to propagate that. So I do understand that. So, once again, just to be clear, I don't personally, based upon what I'm seeing, I don't see the majority of black people willing to bear arms in defense of themselves. They may be willing to, when I say themselves, I'm speaking collectively as a nation, themselves as a nation. Now, they're willing to take arms and defend their own individual assets. Yeah, they would do that. A lot of them would do that. Or they'll take arms just like this black army guy who at Walmart, he was crying about how the army made him the man he is, and that's why he wanted to save the rest of the people who were in there. Now, they'll do things like that because they're African American. As far as being black and as far as being New African, nah, the mass is not doing it. They're not the masses.
To speak to that too, right? I definitely agree with that. I definitely agree with that. I don't know. I feel like whenever it is that we do something of value that's based on valor and confronting the system, it kind of gets, you know, talked about for a little bit, and then it gets swept under the rug. So I don't know if everybody remembers a brother by the name of Mike Xavier Johnson, who had,
mm-hmm.
you know, used his military training, you know what I'm saying, his training to be a warrior on behalf of the United States government in service of his own people.
Right.
And how it's very pertinent that the five officers, or of the five officers that he killed, three of which were confirmed white nationalists and neo-Nazis. And I think, you know, to the point that you made about calling, you know, the police into our communities, we never know what we're going to get. You know, it's almost a crapshoot as to whether or not somebody's going to actually show up and do what it is that we need them to do and leave without somebody being in handcuffs or dead. So I'm definitely at one with you on that. But I kind of wanted to go back a little bit to where you talked about your experience in prison and the police brutality in there. And I wanted you to just tell the listeners, how was it that you reached, you know, this, you know, reached your ability to be able to withstand the attacks that, you know, that you were experiencing and that you were seeing?
Okay, bro, I didn't hear the question all the way because the phone was kind of in and out. So I think you asked about some of my time in prison and my ability to withstand the attacks.
Right, yeah, the attacks that you had to endure and that you had saw, you know, in your environment.
I don't think I'm no much of a bigger person for being able to withstand those attacks because I still am scarred for some of those attacks. I have problems sleeping based upon some of the things that I've experienced in there. I have insomnia, really bad insomnia. It's a lot of brothers and sisters who couldn't withstand those attacks, and probably the reason why they couldn't withstand those attacks is because they probably our circumstances were much different, meaning that you lose your mother, you lose your father, you lose your family in there. So, you know, just because I was able to withstand some of it, I don't think that gives me some type of superior status over those who couldn't for whatever reason. But I do think that one reason that I was able to withstand that is because I had a direction. I knew what my goals and objectives were. I understood who this beast was. And I was prepared mentally for what this beast was going to do to me. And by me understanding my history at the time, I knew what our ancestors had went through every single day, raped every day, being lynched, watching limbs being ripped apart, being eaten by sharks through the transatlantic slave trade. So I feel like I reminded myself that what I was going through was nothing in comparison to what my ancestors had went through. I reminded myself that I was born for a reason, that I came through the womb of my mother for a reason, and I wasn't going to give up until I had fulfilled my purpose. So that reminder made everything easier. It made it so easy to the point where sometimes when the P's came and did what they did, my mind was elsewhere. My body was there, but my mind was elsewhere. I didn't speak. I didn't say stop. I didn't say please. I would not give them the satisfaction of seeing me, the superior man, saying please to him, who's the inferior man. I would not give them that satisfaction. So
right on,
one thing I really believe that when we as a people become conscious of who we are, when we become conscious of who we are, when we really become conscious of who we are, then we win this fight. See, right now we sleep and we ain't conscious of who we are and what we have been and what we're capable of. So that's how they keep us stagnant. That's how they keep us from fighting. That's how they keep us from, as a critical mass, winning this fight. But when the critical mass becomes conscious of who they are, then these people don't stand a chance. They don't stand a chance.
Indeed, they don't.
Right.
So, you know, tell our listeners a little bit about your training. Did you have any formal MMA training, or are you self-taught?
Oh yeah, I'm a professional MMA fighter. I'm the number 5 ranked pro middleweight in the state of Tennessee right now. Even though I know I'm number 1,
yeah, that's
but
right.
However,
I don't.
Even though I know I'm number 1, and they know I'm number 1 too, but you know they the ones who make the numbers. You know they the ones who do that. But they line them up. I just knock them down. So. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm supposed to do. But, yeah, I I have a lot of trainers. I mean, the nature of capitalism is, if the white man sees that he can make some money off of you, he gonna do it. You know, it was at one point where they was like, nah, we don't want him at our gym. We don't want him training with us. We don't want him around us. We don't want him fighting. But the skill set, you know, when you have the skill set, you know, they begin to rationalize about their dollar. You know, so that's pretty much what's going on right now. But, yes, I'm trained. I train every day, 2 and 3 times a day. My off days are mainly Sundays. And Saturday, I train like once a day. I train in jiu-jitsu. I train in Muay Thai. I train in Taekwondo. I train in Ishiru style karate. I train in freestyle wrestling. I box. I do judo. So I pretty much do everything. I pretty much train in everything. That's MMA is the most dominant hand-to-hand combat sport in the world, proven. And I learned every art that could help me to physically dominate the next person. And that's what every other MMA fighter does as well. Try to put the pieces of the puzzle together that will help you physically dominate somebody. And that's the nature of the sport. It's just that raw. That's the reality of it. It's a blood sport. And when I fight in the cage, I'm trying to hurt you because I know you're trying to hurt me. And I'm training to hurt you. I'm learning the techniques that could end the fight as fast as possible. I'm learning to dislocate your shoulder from your trap, you know, to separate your knee, your ankle. I'm learning what it takes to knock you out and when to do that. Mm. I mean, day in and day out, and I'm learning this. And how I'm ascending so fast into this sport, because it is fast, is it goes back once again to knowledge of self, knowledge of ancestry, you know, because a lot of people's like, man, this guy, he ain't been training this long. See, you ask a lot of people, why you fight? They say, you know, they say, well, I fight because I love the sport. Yeah, I love the sport. But I fight for my people. See, that's one thing. I fight for my people. I fight for an oppressed people. I fight for a moral victory, too, because these little black boys and black girls need to see somebody with a red, black, and green flag raise the arm sometimes. They need to see some moral victory sometimes.
That's right.
So I fight for that, too. I fight just so they can see us win something, you know. So I fight for that, too. You know, when they see LeBron James win, you know, he's an American. He's an African-American. Any flag he going to raise up, it's going to be a United States flag, you know. And if I raise up any flag, it's going to be the RB, the red, black, and green flag. And I'm going to speak I'm gonna speak in front of the white people. As I'm going to speak to him the same way, about him the same way I speak to y'all. And I'm going to do it in that cage, too. You know, I'm gonna do it on the radio station as well. I'm going to speak the truth about it. So that's why I fight. So that's why they may be training longer. They may be black belts and brown belts, but I still get in there and I beat them up because we fight for two totally different reasons. You know what I'm saying? So that I already got the advantage over you. That's how I look at it. And it's right now it's proving itself there. Because some of these people, like I just beat a guy who had did karate his whole life, who had been fighting since like 2012. In 2012, I was in prison. And I beat him like he stole something, because in actuality, I looked at him like he did steal something.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
You did steal something. You stole my people.
Yeah,
you stole a lot.
That's right.
You stole a lot. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Your people taking resources from my people right now. You know? The wealth that you have amassed and the reason that you were able to train at such a young age is because of the wealth that you have amassed from stealing and taking from my people. So, yeah, I beat you like you stole something, because you didn't steal something.
Yeah.
You know,
I
take it out on you. I take it out on you. So that's I think that gives me an advantage.
And brother, I swear, man, you're not only telling your story, man, but you're speaking to my soul right now, man. I'm an avid, you know what I'm saying, fan of MMA. I do a little training myself as far as Krav Maga, and a lot of the reason why I even feel like that training is necessary is for the open enemy who has declared war on us. Like, for no other reason. I mean, he has a physical aspect, you know, a mental aspect, a spiritual aspect, but the number one reason is to be able to, like you said, man, to defend our nation, man, and the vast majority of our nation is made up of our sisters, man, and they definitely need brothers that's willing to lay it out on the line and be able to actually, you know, do some damage and be remembered, you know what I'm saying, after the damage is done. But, yeah, I'm going to turn it down just a little bit, and I wanted to ask you something because I'm into, you know, a little inflicting pain on people. But you might have a sister uptown who says, you know what, I have a son. I want him to get into organized sports, but I don't want him learning that type of stuff, you know, to actually hurt people. What would you – if you could say something to our listeners who might be a little turned off by, you know, knowing the type of pain and damage that can be inflicted, like what would you say to them about the benefits of training, you know, outside of the aspect of violence?
Outside of the aspect of violence, I will first say that the most violent people on the face of the planet are white people. Look at what they did to Emmett Till. look at what they did to Dante Farrow. Look at what they continue to do to our youth. So I will first remind the sister of that her son, regardless of what Greek fraternity he's in, regardless of what type of grades he makes inside of white schools, is always a threat to white men and white women. He always poses a threat. Bill Cosby poses a threat. So he always poses a threat. But outside of violence, even though it's hard for me to even say what we do is violent, because it's necessary. We are only defending ourselves, even what the brother Makai X did. He was only defending us. We're only defending ourselves. We're only reacting to what they are doing to us. But outside of that, it teaches it helps discipline you. See, I don't go around beating people up at all, because I know what I. You could talk trash to me all day long. I'm just thinking, man, you don't even know what you're getting yourself into. I'm gonna just keep on walking.
Right. Right.
I know you frustrated, brother, and you want to fight, but you don't even know how to throw a punch. I can hit you one time, and you'll wake up tomorrow and miss work. You know?
Right.
So it teaches discipline. That's one thing. I mean, it teaches discipline. Even if you don't become a professional fighter, it teaches organization, meaning to be organized throughout your day, throughout your work, throughout whatever it is that you're doing, to be tactful, to be disciplined. That's the biggest thing that I get from it. And it teaches you how to work through pain. I think black people need to learn how to work through pain, work through mental pain, because we suffer from mental side where we battle daily with certain afflictions and certain things that we can't even explain. Most of us can't even explain the types of thoughts we have and why we have these types of thoughts that we do have. The listeners may know, and you, brother, and you, sister, may know that, you know, due to white supremacy, we ain't in our right mind right now. So I think black people need to learn how to work through mental pain, learning MMA, fighting and training every day and being in physical pain every day. The physical and the mental connected. So being that the physical and the mental are connected, fighting teaches you how to work through mental pain as well. Because when you become exhausted, you start thinking slower. It's strategy. It's not just going out fighting hard as you can. It's actually timing. It's recognizing someone's strengths. It's recognizing the next person's weaknesses. It's recognizing your own strengths and your own weaknesses as well. So it teaches a lot of things, and it's very beneficial.
So,
you definitely. What you say,
bro? I said you were on point, bro.
Yeah,
I encourage everyone to learn.
I want to take a second and give thanks for your mother.
Oh,
for
yes.
Giving you that foundation. Yeah. Please let her know that we give thanks for her existence. And for her, giving her children, giving her family that foundation.
Absolutely.
I will do.
Absolutely. Honor her, man.
If anybody want to see her, follow her on Facebook on one of the pages if they're not blocked. Mary Sunshine
Dexter Hermaine Page and Sunshine Mary. Or is it those two pages. Mary Sunshine and
yes.
Sunshine
okay.
Mary.
Shout out to Mama Mary. Yes, yes. Shout out to Mama Mary.
Yes, please. Is that the best way, like, so that, like, we can keep up with your work and, like, you know, just different things that you're doing, your fights and all of that? Is that the best way for us to keep up with that on Facebook?
I'm not really, really big on savvy, but I do have some pages that my sisters has a double major. One of her majors is in sports management. I hope you guys hear me on my side now. One of her majors is in sports management. She's actually my manager.
Okay.
She has a master's degree in sports management. And so she pretty much deals with my pages. So, of course, I'm mainly on Facebook so the people can follow me on Facebook. I can send you some links, too, so the people can follow me and keep up with me. And I definitely do need the people to support me in what I'm doing because the majority of these white people have big sponsors behind them. They have big money behind them. Being that, like I say, me fighting is a job, and I don't get paid much at this time for this job, and I definitely don't get paid for teaching the people how to fight. I'm not looking to get paid for that. But it's definitely a job. I definitely have to be helped. I have real injuries and all types of injuries. So I do want the support. It doesn't even have to be financial support. Just the support. I want the people to know that why I'm fighting and where I'm fighting and to just be looking out and to just be sharing stuff and saying stuff so that we can make this next jump. Because some white folks support their Conor McGregors when he come in with his Irish flag. And they support their Kobe Covington who wears his MAGA, Make America Great Again. When I come
right.
in the stadium with a red, black, and green flag on, I get booed. You know, when I come in with a red, black, and green mask on, I get booed. When I go to try to get sponsors from businesses, I can't get them because of my Facebook content and because of some of the things that I say. I can't get a dime from them. So everything that we do is pretty much out of pocket. Even when I go to black businesses and try to get sponsors from them, I can't get it because black people think individualistically. They think, you know, they think on a rugged individualism type of level, but then they'll turn around and call and say, hey, we want our son or our daughter to come to a class. And you know, they want it for free. You know, even though I offer free training, but to, like, I'm in the gym right now, God Body Fitness and Nutrition. I have to pay to be there to have classes. So I can't do free classes all the time. I go to community centers every couple months to do free classes or wherever I can go and do free classes or a park and do free classes or a neighborhood and do free classes. So, but, yeah, I need support from our people. I need the support. I definitely need the support. I would be lying if I say I didn't need the support. I need the support.
Okay.
It's hard, man. It's hard. But when I get booed, I love getting booed because when if white folks cheering me on, they mean I'm doing something wrong.
Yeah, that's right.
And I get up in there in red, black, and green, and white folks say, yeah, we love you. I'm like, hold on, what I just do wrong? I just did something wrong. I mean, because they ain't supposed to love me. They ain't supposed to love me. They supposed to hate me because of what I'm fighting for. They don't love the righteous. They don't love the righteous. They're not supposed to love me. So when I hear them booing, I hear cheering for my ancestors. I hear them booing, I embrace it. I mean, y'all just don't understand how much I love to hear white people booing. And I love to see their face when I walk past them. When I walk past them, I love to see that face that they make, like that look of disgust that they have. I love it. I love it. I'm just being honest. I love the sport. Person has that when they know I'm stuck up and then I beat their son up and leave. I love it.
Yeah, right on, brother. Right on, man. And listen, man, as much as you love hearing them boo, man, we love that you're getting in there and you're doing your thing, man. Really,
I'm about to fight again September 28th.
September 28th.
That fight just got confirmed tonight. Today, about an hour ago. So I'm fighting me
It's gonna be in Memphis. It's gonna be in Memphis. I thought I was gonna leave to go fight. I thought I was going to Mississippi to go fight at one of these casinos because it's hard to find fights. And the guy just made something happen. You know, Memphis, like the South, people don't understand that this sport is growing so much that it's a lot of fighting going on. I mean, that's how fast this sport is growing. There's a lot of fighting going on everywhere. There's a lot of fighting going on. And hopefully, you know, I'll be one of the best and that the black people would see me and view me that way. I mean, that's what I fight for. I fight for resources, though. I do understand that as much as I learn, I mean, my ultimate goal is to bring it back. Just to bring it back. So that's one of the things I fight for. But so 2/28, the fight just got confirmed. I'm fighting here in Memphis, Tennessee at the FedEx Forum. That's where the Grizzlies play at, Memphis Grizzlies play. I'm fighting at the FedEx Forum, September 28th. I'm fighting a race warrior, and I plan on bashing his face in. I mean, so just being honest as possible. Y'all have a fighter on the show today, so I'm just being honest as possible. I plan on kicking him in the face, and I plan on putting him to sleep, and I don't stop until the referee stops the fight. So, like, I get paid to try to kill you, and the referee gets paid for him to stop me from killing you. So that's how I go in. I say, I'm going to do my job, and the ref needs to do theirs. My job is to try to kill you, and the referee's job is to stop me from killing you. So that's how I go in there when I fight them. I go in there with controlled rage.
Because
I am mad. Yeah, you can watch. It'll be on, you know, you can watch everything now. It's going to be streamed on pay-per-view or something like that. I can send you the link that it's going to be on. But it's definitely going to be streamed. I think they charge like $20 for it. But at some point, they will put it on YouTube, too, at some point. The league, they normally release those fights after a couple weeks or 3 weeks or something like that. They normally release them. But, yeah. You can watch.
When do you see yourself getting an opportunity to fight for the belt?
Well, as an amateur, I was undefeated as an amateur, and I did have a title then. You know, I traveled to fight. I traveled throughout the South and fought and beat everybody that they put in front of me, and finished just about everybody that they put in front of me, except for a couple people. So I haven't lost yet. Don't plan on it. But I will be fighting for a belt hopefully by the beginning of the year if I don't sustain another serious injury. I will be fighting for some type of belt. Attitude MMA belt is going to be up for grabs. V3, something, you know. But based upon the landscape right now, I can foresee myself being in the UFC within the next couple of years. Maybe by this time next year, I'll probably – based upon my trajectory at this point, maybe next year I could be on the contender series or something like that. Maybe next year, that's what we're talking about. But I'm taking it one fight at a time right now, and hopefully real soon some of these doors gonna open. I have teammates who are already in the UFC, so I know the type of training that I need. I know the level that I'm at right now. I know I'm one of the best fighters. Probably in the world, one of the best, because I train with some of the best fighters in the world, literally. I train with Olympic gold medalists, and I do more than hold my own against them. So I know where I stand, and hopefully this time next year I can be on the biggest stage fight, holding red, white, and green flag.
We can't wait to see that, brother, on a big stage like that, being able to, you know, represent your people at that level. Yeah, we definitely asking the ancestors, man, to help guide your hand and get you to that point, man, where you need to be, you know, personally and for your nation, man. We definitely supporting you, brother.
Thank you. It's appreciated, brother.
And before you go, brother, I wanted to ask you about something that you mentioned briefly yesterday about what you were going to be doing in Mississippi with some property down
but
there,
money.
Agriculture.
Okay.
Okay, I mentioned, okay, and my mother deals directly with it more so than, well, I wouldn't say more so than I do, but on the economic level, yeah, more so than I do, because I deal primarily with grassroots organizing and the youth and the young men, so to speak, and I deal with, like I said, community response type of stuff. So we definitely have everything broken down. Everybody doesn't do everything. But what's going on in Mississippi right now, like I said, the Black Liberation Movement owns land. And I know by saying own, you know, my political belief is that even if we so-called own it, we don't own it because we got to pay taxes for it, and it's still controlled by white people. They just allow us to control it at some point. And hell, we're going through that right now down in Mississippi, and a lot of times we go through that when we so-called own a house. If you don't pay the property taxes on the house, they'll take it. We know the nature of this beast. But however, under the construct of racism, white supremacy, we own land as a collective. And what the collective decided to do, Patrick Alexander being the chief facilitator of the Black Liberation Movement, what the collective decided to do with the land was begin the farming initiative. So the farming initiative began. Tomatoes are grown, watermelons are grown, squashes grown, greens are grown, zucchini is grown, and we set up farmers markets throughout the area and to disperse it amongst the people. And the goal and the objective is for the food to be clean, to be GMO free, to be free from pesticides and things of this nature, and to be as cheap as possible. The only money, that the only profit that should be made is enough that pays the laborer for what the labor is worth. So we understand that under the system of capitalism that money must be made, but the goal of the farming initiative is to feed the people. So the only profit that should be garnered, that is being garnered, is to go right back into the Black Liberation Movement to pay for some of the things that we do and to pay the laborers what their labor is worth. So, yeah, you can look it up. You can follow Patrick Alexander or Sister Crystal Denise, who's also a member of the Black Liberation Movement. My mother, Mary Sunshine, Crystal Denise, actually, too, also has another organization that's pretty much inside the Black Liberation Movement called the Oasis Center, in which she teaches childhood literacy. Like I say, these organizations, this stuff is not government funded. Money is not taken through any government type of avenues whatsoever. It is all raised by us. We don't go out and we don't do GoFundMes. We don't solicit money from the people. We get out on the ground. We don't do what Umar Johnson and them do. I mean, I know everybody got their issue and people for them or whatever, but we don't do these right. Brothers and sisters have done. We don't solicit funds from our people who are already hurting, who are already hungry, who are already starving. We get out here as a collective and we figure out how we're going to make the money to get what we need to get done. So, like I said, we had the Oasis Center. We have, the self-defense classes going. We have the farming initiative going. We have the sisters also, Sister Mama Ayo with Rhythm and Wellness. We have a bunch of organizations, and they all work as one. We all work as one collectively.
Oh.
I'm sorry, y'all did not, my phone went out, right? I don't know what the last thing y'all heard. I don't even know what the last thing,
no.
I apologize.
No, it didn't go out. I mean,
I apologize.
I don't think
yeah, no, here it
went out.
Okay. Okay.
But I just want to thank you for all of the insight, the encouragement, the motivation. This call was like really motivated, really motivating for Black August, because it's just so, the physical aspect is so important. I feel like we lacking it and we got to get back on track.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with our children and everything. Like, we should be raising our children, like, to be training.
Mm-hmm.
as early as possible and as much as they can tolerate, you know, at an early age. So I'm glad to have you call this evening. Yeah, give our listeners and us a lot of fruit for us to build on.
I appreciate y'all having me.
Yes, ma'am. Definitely.
I'm glad that we have you.
I appreciate
you. I'm glad that the youth have you, because we do need someone like us that's going to wave that flag to represent us. We need that, and it's important. It makes us feel good. Like, I've never met you, but, you know, just knowing that you are here, it makes me feel good. And
right.
I know I'm not the only one that feel that way. Like, you know, we need that. We need those. We need that reality.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. That mentality has been missing from sports for a long time, man. It's about time we start talking about some new brothers. I mean, Muhammad Ali was who he is, but it's about time we start being able to pass on that legacy in the new generations. And I'm definitely gonna put my son D to you, and let him know that, you know, if he can check you out, man. It's not just for an introduction. I want him to see you raise that red, black, and green flag. So we can be like, damn, daddy, somebody fighting, they be talking about what you be talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, man, that's what we need, man.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's organized, you know, that's doing that. That's also organizing, working with the people, like, you know, just grounded. So we're happy to have you on tonight. Thank you for taking the time out of your extremely busy schedule. Thank you for taking the time for us and for the people to give us that this evening. And
I also forgot
to say, if anybody had any questions or comments, to hit one. We got like a few minutes left, but I forgot to say that. But if anybody had any questions or comments, can you go ahead and hit one now? If not, we can close up. Brother Tasim, did you have anything else?
No, not really.
September 28th.
Yeah, most definitely. I'm just feeling the brother's energy right now, man. This is Black August. You know, we 400 years from the first Africans touching these shores in North America and chains. And, you know, at least, you know, in the development of the United States through the 13 colonies. And I'm feeling that indomitable spirit, man, in this brother, man. It's been definitely a great pleasure and an honor to have you on here to talk about everything that you're involved in, and that you're not just, you know, committing all your energy to sports. You're really about the liberation and the reclaiming of the land of your people. So in saying that, man, I salute you, brother.
Thank you, brother. I salute y'all for doing what y'all are doing as well.
Yes, and we want to send you and your family send some energy and some prayers for you all, that you will be blessed abundantly in every aspect, that you will be protected. The ancestors will continue to guide and protect you, and we just pray and give energy that you will be very successful in all of your endeavors, and that you will be rewarded for all of the good seeds that you are planting.
Yes, I say.
Free the land.
I say. So, free the land. Good night, everyone.
Free the land by any means necessary.